want to remind all council, if you haven't already done so, please make sure you sign the sign-in sheets, make sure we know who was here. All right. Next case we'll hear is Wayne Antonio Bland versus the Commonwealth. Ms. Dalton, Mr. Katz. Ms. Dalton, how are you doing today?
Good morning. If I could reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, please.
It'll be fine.
On behalf of Wayne Bland, may it please the court. I'm Dorian Dalton. The issue in this case is reasonable articulable suspicion. Specifically, our argument is that the police lacked reasonable articulable suspicion both to stop Bland and to pat him down.
Well, we have an anonymous caller here, but we don't have just any anonymous caller. We have someone who is on a cell phone to police communications 911 call, and they're describing in detail a guy standing in a street corner in Richmond waving a gun in the air. They give a fairly accurate description of his race, height, his race and what he's wearing, and his gender. And the police officers are dispatched to the area, and they find someone there who matches the description. And I guess the question would be, why doesn't Navarette basically permit exactly what was done here? The United States Supreme Court decision in Navarette seems to be squarely on point here, doesn't it?
I would submit that Navarette certainly is the case to look at as to determining the reliability of this 911 call, but that this particular 911 call, even under the, I guess, factors of reliability that Navarette expounds, is not sufficiently reliable in and of itself to provide reasonable articulable suspicion. As the court pointed out, the call was anonymous. It was not made by a known informant or an identified party. The caller does not identify herself in any way. She does not give her name or address. She told the 911 operator that she did not want to speak to the police when they came. And most importantly, she doesn't provide her basis for knowing the information about the brandishing. She does not say that she was an eyewitness to it or when it occurred, just that she was witnessing the man walk down the street with the gun. The call contains no predictive behavior, no indication of inside information, and the tip must be reliable in the assertion of criminal activity, not just in the identification of a particular person. And the Navarette court did hold that even if a reliable tip, even if a tip found to be reliable, will support an investigative stop only if it creates reasonable articulable suspicion of an ongoing crime rather than reporting an isolated episode of completed criminal conduct.
We have three cases seem to me we have to reconcile here. We have Florida versus JL, and we have Navarette, and we have Alabama versus White. None of them say that you can never, ever, ever, ever rely on anonymous tips or information to support reasonable suspicion.
Certainly.
But, you know, JL and Alabama versus White kind of expressed some parameters about that. Both were decided in days before cell phones were prevalent. Navarette, the most recent case from 2014, notes that some of the considerations in JL that were raised, you know, the fact that anonymous tipster can't be held responsible for their bad information, is less of a factor in the days of cell phones and 911 and caller ID and that sort of thing, where the caller can be easily traced back. Navarette also talks about the reliability can be found where there's an explicit and detailed description of both criminal activity and the suspect, and also that they're observing it firsthand.
Right.
We have all of those factors here, don't we?
I disagree that we do, Your
Honor. Tell me where we don't.
Okay. With respect to, we have a 911 call. We definitely have that. And Navarette explicitly states the 911 calls are not per se reliable. The dissent in Navarette, Justice Scalia notes that there's no reason to believe that the average anonymous 911 tipster is aware that he is identifiable, and it is the tipster's belief in anonymity, not the reality, that controls his behavior. In this case, we do not have this caller indicating that she realized that she is traceable. We don't. I think that Your Honor is presuming that she's calling from a cell phone. I don't know that we even have that information. I don't know that we know whose cell phone she's calling from. I don't know that we don't know that she's in a house phone and that it's her house or someone else's house. With respect to the contemporaneous aspect of it, she is clearly reporting some events contemporaneously. She's reporting that she sees the man on Red Street, what he's wearing, that she's an eyewitness to seeing him walking down the street.
And waving a gun around, which is pretty significant, too.
The police report that dispatch had told them that he is waving a gun around. The actual 911 call, she says he has a gun in his hand as he's walking down the street. And when the 911 operator kind of presses her on where exactly is the gun, she kind of wavers between it being in his pocket and in his hand. So I don't really know which word to presume the gun actually is. Either way, whether it's in his hand or in his pocket, she's not saying that he is currently brandishing the gun. She's not saying that he is currently waving the gun around. She's reporting brandishing, and that's her word, has occurred. She said he walked out here brandishing a gun in front of a female. We know that that's in the past because she reports that he entered the house of 1947 Accommodation Street. He's on Red Street now. And when asked or when pressed by the 911 operator, is anybody injured? Is everybody okay? Do you know that information? The caller reports that the young lady, who she's presuming is this man's girlfriend, had already left out of with the children out of the house and walked down the street, and that he had also, since the time of the brandishing, entered the house. She and the children leave the house. He leaves the house, and now he's walking down Red Street. So we know that the brandishing is in the past. We don't know that she's an eyewitness to the brandishing because she never says that she's an eyewitness to the brandishing, and she never explains how she knows that information. Did she witness it herself? Did somebody report to her that it happened? It would be unusual, I would point out, had she witnessed the brandishing that alarmed her to the point of calling 911, she wouldn't have waited to make sure that everybody's okay and then called report it. She would have, presumably, if she had access to a telephone, called 911 as she's seeing it, as she perceives clearly danger to the children or to this woman who she already knows is okay. So looking at the Navarette factors, we really don't have contemporaneous report. We don't have a short time period. We have a short time period between when she calls in and when the police respond. We have no time frame as to know when the brandishing occurred, except that we know that additional events have transpired since the brandishing and that the danger has sort of dissipated as she perceived it.
Counsel, the call was made to the Department of Emergency Communications. I was going to ask, do you concede that the call to this agency was a 911 call? And as I'm hearing your argument, I guess the answer is yes, you do.
Yes, I concede that it was a 911 call. Yes. It is our position that the tip then does not provide adequate reliability to provide reasonable articulable suspicion. Then looking as to whether the tip is corroborated, basically the police respond, they are able to corroborate only location and, I guess, the clothing. There's a description match, there's a location match. But the mere fact that the tip, if true, would describe illegal activity does not mean that the police can make an investigative stop without meeting the reliability requirement. So since they cannot corroborate the illegal activity, the tip itself is not reliable enough to establish the criminal activity part, they have a match to the identity. They have to know that this is the person in the call. All they observe at that point is the behavior of patting the pockets. The man's not waving a gun, he doesn't have a gun in his hand, and they don't observe a weapon-like bulge in his clothing.
Well, if they have information that, setting the anonymous tipster issue aside, assuming we get past that, are you asserting that information that someone is armed or is armed and was armed in the recent past is insufficient, standing alone, to justify a pat-down?
Your Honor, if I could answer that in two parts. I would submit a call to the police that someone is armed does not allege a crime. So if the police know that someone is
armed. Well, that isn't the criteria for a pat-down. The purpose of a pat-down is to protect the officer, essentially. In other words, assuming reasonable suspicion exists under Terry, then the officer is entitled to briefly detain the individual and investigate whether or not there, in fact, is a crime about to be committed or has just been committed. And the pat-down, or at least the rationale for the pat-down, is to make sure, while conducting that investigation, the officer's not at some risk.
And I think the court just illustrated the missing part here, and that would be that in order to do a pat-down, they need reasonable articulable suspicion that the person's armed and dangerous, but they also need reasonable articulable suspicion of criminal activity to detain that person. So if the police have reasonable articulable suspicion to detain someone, or for any other reason they are lawfully interacting with them, and they have reason to believe that they're presently armed and dangerous, then yes, they can pat them down.
Are you at all familiar with the case of United States versus Robinson that was decided by the Fourth Circuit about 2.5 weeks ago?
I'm somewhat familiar, but perhaps the court could remember.
Well, interestingly enough, the court, and our understanding that Fourth Circuit cases aren't binding on this court
sure.
necessarily, but the Fourth Circuit held in that case that because the language of Terry is that the person is both armed and dangerous, it was insufficient to just indicate that they were armed, especially, I think the case came out of West Virginia where everybody apparently is now armed because they have open carry and no requirement for a permit to carry concealed weapons. So the operative words were there has to be some indicia of being dangerous as well.
Sure.
Now, of course, if you're waving a gun around, I think that might satisfy that. But
when the police
Robinson may have some impact on your argument. I just wondered if you were familiar with it.
Not to that extent, Your Honor. And I think that it's clear that he's not waving the gun around when the police get there. That if that's the dangerous behavior, that dangerousness is not present. In addition, that the caller indicated that what she perceived to be the dangerousness had subsided. That everybody was uninjured and safe at that point, and the parties had separated from one another. And if that answered the court's questions, I'm going to save the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Katz, good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Benjamin Katz, appearing on behalf of the Commonwealth. Your Honor pointed out that Navarette is certainly the controlling case under these facts. I would like to back up and speak more broadly about the jurisprudence in this regard. It is well settled. When it comes to anonymous tips, the issue is the indicia of reliability around them. And I think it's useful to consider it is only necessary to corroborate or bolster the reliability of the tip when there isn't any establishment of the basis of the knowledge of the tip provided. And here we have a finding by the trial court, and that's at page 58 of the joint appendix, that this person was an eyewitness to these crimes. And clearly, as I pointed out in the Commonwealth's Exhibit 1 that was passed up in accordance with the writ of certiorari, we have in the 911 call, which was admitted into evidence and played in the proceeding, that the individual who called this tip in witnessed this person brandish a gun in front of a female near a field full of children. That's at 27 seconds to 38 seconds of the recording. So I think the record evidence before this court is clear. We have an individual who saw this crime, who saw the brandishing. And there certainly hasn't been any challenge to the factual finding made by the trial court.
Let me interrupt you, Mr. Katz. This just occurred to me as you were talking, and maybe this is not sufficiently developed in the record, but I'll ask the question anyway. What is an anonymous tip to begin with? In other words, one definition would arguably be where you simply have bare information in context about criminal activity without knowing anything about the source of that information, basically anything meaningful at all about the source of that information. While here we clearly don't have the caller's name, and again, maybe the record doesn't develop this, but these days, whether you're calling on almost any kind of phone, there's caller ID, you know, enhanced E911 if it's a 911 call. I don't know, most if not all police departments in Virginia are part of the E911 system. So it's outside the record, but I'm familiar with E911 from my former life, and up pops the name and address of the account holder of the phone when you make a call to 911. So do you truly have an anonymous tip? What's the Commonwealth's position here in the first instance, or do we even need to get to that point here?
Certainly, Your Honor, and I think I would respond to it this way. I think if we go back far enough, tips fell into two categories, where you had known tipsters who had cooperated in the past, and there was some way to assess their reliability based upon the convictions obtained from the information they had provided, whether they'd been previously convicted of offenses, and then a much larger category of people who were not known to have provided tips in the past. And I think, as Your Honor points out, as the jurisprudence has evolved from White and JL and now Navarette, that larger body, that larger community of people who are not cooperating tipsters, but just normal people who are reporting crimes, while they are anonymous, there are things that make those tips reliable so that they're not anonymous as it was in the past before the jurisprudence. And what we look to is being an eyewitness, calling 911, a contemporaneous account. And so I think Navarette traces, as Your Honor points out, that it's different than it was in the past. It isn't truly anonymous. And for those reasons, we give those tips greater reliability. We credit them as being reliable and not requiring the same kind of corroboration or bolstering as we would a bare tip that's just, well, this person's traveling a station wagon and they're going to have drugs with them. It's different than that. It's qualitatively different.
How would you respond to Ms. Dalton's argument, essentially, that the caller has to know that they're really not as anonymous as they might think in order for all of that? In other words, the fact that they are more traceable, you know, if somebody wants to go to the effort of tracking them down, that it's not that hard, how does that impact on the reliability issue if the person, you know, it's like a, does a tree make noise in the forest, you know, if nobody's around to hear it fall?
I think my initial answer for this court and this specific case is because that is not the only reason that that makes this tip reliable, the fact that it was called to 911, that is a factor, but it is not the only factor. And the fact that it is an eyewitness report is a much stronger indication of reliability. So my initial answer to Your Honor is it's not necessary to resolve that in this specific case. Were that the only circumstance, my answer to Your Honor would be, I think it is significant, the subjective belief of the caller. I would note that that is dicta. It is certainly not binding on this court. It's a factor the court could consider as to whether it's reliable. But in light of the fact that we have a factual finding that this caller was an eyewitness to the crime in progress, it isn't necessary to resolve that issue in this specific case. What I would argue is the reliance in the defendant's opening brief is on the testimony of the officers at the hearing alone, without reference to the actual recording. And the actual recording makes clear, and the court found, that this brandishing was witnessed by this caller. And in accordance with Navarette, that made the tip reliable. There was no need for additional corroboration or additional bolstering at that point. But moreover, the tip indicated that the gun was in the individual's pocket. And when the officers see him, matching the description provided, you see in the record the officer saw movement that in the officer's training and experience was consistent with what he termed a weapons check. And in accordance with seeing that, at that point, a reasonable person under those circumstances was justified in suspecting this person to be armed and dangerous, justifying the pat-down of the defendant. I would be happy to answer any additional questions that the panel may have.
Given modern technology, we're not yet down to resolving Judge Humphrey's question of what is now an anonymous tip. Correct?
Well, that is true. I think what I would say in light of Navarette is there is a universe of tips that are anonymous, and there are circumstances surrounding those tips that make some more reliable than others. And so
well, there's certainly great gradations of anonymity. I don't think there's any question about that.
That's right.
Absolutely. And it depends on the facts of the case and the circumstances.
It's like we're getting down only to the potential issue of not knowing the name at the time, or identifying the caller identifying his or her name.
They'll probably put chips in our head any day now. So
that's
well.
True.
If there are no other questions, I would ask the court to affirm the denial.
Thank you, Mr. Katz. Ms. Dalton?
Briefly, the Commonwealth argues that we only need to corroborate if it's an anonymous tip only need to be corroborated if it's an unknown what the basis of the tipster's knowledge is, but that's not true. The standard is reliability. There are a lot of other factors, including credibility. We don't know here her basis of knowledge, and that's the key issue, not as much her credibility that we don't have any reason, but we also don't know as to what her motivation is in calling. But here we don't know how she knows about the alleged brandishing. She does not state that she saw it occur. She states that it happened. And I think with respect to her understanding of whether or not she's anonymous, I would point out again that she doesn't give her name, but most importantly, when the 911 operator concludes the call by saying, "Do you wish to speak to the police when they get there?" She is like, "Absolutely not," and gives a somewhat strange reason being that she's on a different street, which I think is sort of a non-reason in the sense that she just doesn't want to talk to police, she just doesn't want to get involved, but also then brings up the issue of, well, where is this woman? We were assuming that she's at a certain location, and all of a sudden she's saying, no, I'm on a totally different street than this guy that I'm supposedly watching. Additionally, the Commonwealth maintains that the trial court made a finding that the caller was an eyewitness. The trial court, again, didn't make a finding that the caller was an eyewitness to the brandishing or to the waving of a gun. The trial court, on page 58 of the appendix, held that this is a citizen that is actually witnessing the events or perhaps a crime occurring, meaning she is saying she's seeing something. And it's very clear when you actually look at the 911 call what she's actually seeing and then what she may have seen but does not actually provide us with the basis for knowing it. And I would submit that a more reasonable inference is that someone else told her that it happened, and that explains the delay in her reporting it if she perceives the situation to be dangerous. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Dalton. We'll come down and greet counsel.